dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I have admired for a long time, because we have been colleagues for quite a number of years now, is our first guest. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He is the director and senior analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism at the Center for Security Policy, and has really emerged as one of the country's premier experts on the kinds of threats posed to our country by the enemies domestic as well as foreign, and particularly those of the, well, I think of it as Sharia supremacist stripe, but also the Marxist strain of totalitarianism. And this was the subject of Kyle Scheidler's very distinguished testimony at a recent hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee, a subcommittee of it chaired by Senator Ted Cruz in mid-August. And it's great to have a chance finally to visit with him. We've been trying to arrange this conversation for some time, and things keep intervening, but it's so good to have you with us. Kyle Scheidler, thank you for A, your testimony, and B, for joining us to talk a little bit about it. The subject of the hearing was about Antifa, and there was some drama between the members, and we'll come to that in a moment. But Kyle, I wanted just to start with sort of the thrust of your comments about the nature of Antifa and the role that it's playing at the moment in these civil disturbances that are taking place across the country.
Sure. Well, Frank, as you know, maybe better than anyone, one of the hallmarks of the Center of Security Policy is when we're looking at a threat analysis of an American enemy, our primary question is, what do they say they believe? And what do they say they intend to do? And then we take this seriously.
It's sort of stunning that that's such an extraordinary thing. You'd think that's where everybody would start, wouldn't you?
It's far less common in Washington, D.C. than one might think. But this is our approach. And so this was the approach that I took to looking at Antifa in preparation for this hearing. And what I really came to the conclusion of was that Antifa is the latest formulation of a long process of revolution in the United States. Many of the founders and supporters of Antifa in the leadership cadre are longtime members of the hard left. You're talking about people who were members of the Weather Underground terrorist organization in the 1960s and 70s. People with a long history of violent insurrection against the United States. This is actually true for Antifa internationally as well. When it was first founded in Germany in the early 1980s, it was founded by people who were coming out of the ideology of the Red Army faction and these other communist urban terrorist and urban guerrilla organizations. So this is their background. And if you read the early documents from groups like the Weather Underground, you can see the language of Antifa today very clearly in it. You get this tone that, you know, the entire American system is white supremacy and must be overthrown. America is inherently racist. You know, we see that as now the leading conversation in academia and really even in government and in corporate America today. And so tracing that language and tracing that the ideological roots of Antifa in the streets back to that period was one of the things I wanted to make clear in the testimony.
So you give a bit of the intellectual as well as philosophical, ideological, if you will, pedigree of this operation, and you come up with essentially a Marxist revolutionary operation. The mood in the subcommittee seemed to be divided between, well, Senator Cruz, notably the chairman of the subcommittee, and on the one hand, who I gather was properly interested and open to and sympathetic about your findings, Kyle Scheidler, but on the other side of the aisle, the Democrats were not so much. Mazie Hirono of Hawaii was a particularly discordant voice on this subject, and as I recall, sort of walked out of the room refusing to disassociate herself from the Antifa movement, something that I gather the Senator Cruz was frustrated he couldn't get any Democrat to do.
It was a little disheartening, Frank. I have to be honest with you. One, the interest level in the Senate subcommittee in general was low. Other than Senator Cruz, there were very few senators that chose to engage on the topic much at all. And certainly none of the Democratic senators, you mentioned that moment with Mazie Hirono, Senator Hirono in particular, but none of the Democratic senators were willing to condemn Antifa, condemn the violence taking place in Portland, or even to acknowledge that it existed. And worse than that, Frank, they bought into the central propaganda line of Antifa. They openly called American federal law enforcement agent Gestapo, stormtroopers, secret police. They blatantly told falsehoods about what federal law enforcement was doing in Portland. In the first panel, the panel before mine, acting secretary or deputy secretary Ken Cuccinelli did a really masterful job defending his department from these attacks, but they were pretty ferocious, and they were directly along, as I said, along this propaganda line that the American cops are the bad guys and Antifa are the good guys. And it was really sad to see.
It's really stunning. And Ken Cuccinelli of the Department of Homeland Security, I think, is an exemplar of, you know, the kind of conscientious, competent law enforcement officer at the moment in that present role, who is doing his duty, as I think they all are, under very difficult circumstances. And the fact that senior officials in our Congress are so hostile to that work is enabling, I'm quite confident, and legitimating Antifa, not putting it into a proper perspective for Americans. Let me ask you, finally, speaking of Mazie Hirono, she managed to burden herself of some cheap shots at, well, yours truly, but also the Center for Security Policy, and I just wanted to give you both a chance to talk a little bit about it and to thank you for rising so handsomely to the defense of our organization against charges that she sort of parroted from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Quick word on that?
Yeah, Frank, it was really kind of sad. You know, she was reading this sort of rote Wikipedia SPLC fluff that we see just come up again and again and again. And, you know, and fortunately, Senator Cruz allowed me a chance to rebut that. And I was able to say, you know, the reality is the Center for Security Policy does a broad amount of work on national security topics. Now, one of those topics is jihad and jihadist ideology and the threat that comes from it. And we're proud of that work. And we're proud of, for example, the Muslim senior fellows that we have on staff that help us in, you know, rooting out jihadists and jihadist ideology in American communities. And we think that's important work. And so I was glad that we got a chance to say that.
Well, and I appreciate you doing it so well, and commend to our audience the video of your appearance there. And it's, I know, at the Center for Security Policy's website, securefreedom.org. Kyle Scheidler, thanks for all you do for our country, our cause, and for the center. And please come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Gordon Chang joins us next. We'll talk China and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. One of the high points of this week, each week, is our visit with Gordon Chang. He is in the house virtually, we're delighted to say. He is, of course, one of the country's preeminent experts on China and, well, East Asia more generally, the author of several important books, including The Coming Collapse of China. He is also the fellow who can be followed closely, I hope, at Twitter's Gordon G. Chang handle. And you can find his writings in a variety of other places. We are also always particularly grateful for his appearances here, as well as in Fox and other outlets. Gordon, it's good to have you with us, my friend. Welcome back. Let's talk about one of the things that you've written up recently, Gordon, in National Interest, a piece that called to mind the policies of the Obama-Biden administration at a time when China was rapaciously taking over the South China Sea. And you focused in particularly on the Scarborough Shoal episode in that drama. Is this likely to be, as you see it, Gordon, a sort of template for how Joe Biden would work the China portfolio were he to be our next commander-in-chief?
I'm very concerned that Scarborough Shoal would be the template. Also, I'm concerned that it could be the world's next crisis because there is a simmering dispute which is continuing. It's heating up in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines. Scarborough Shoal was long thought to be part of the Philippines. In 2012, both Chinese and Philippine vessels swarmed the feature, which is very close to Luzon, the main island in the Philippines. The State Department brokered an agreement for both sides to withdraw their craft. Only the Philippines complied. That has left China in control of the feature ever since. And the White House decided not to confront China over that. They did not want friction. But what they did do was they emboldened the worst elements in the Chinese political system by showing everybody else that aggression worked. And soon after that, China started to pressure other Philippine features in the South China Sea. They started to reclaim those features in the Spratlys, in the southern portion of that body of water, making them into artificial islands and then military bases. And then China ramped up its pressure on Japan in the East China Sea over the Senkakus, which China also claims is the Diaoyus. So Beijing just went out and made the problem bigger. And this, I think, is symptomatic of the approach of the Obama-Biden team. And I'm worried that Biden, if he were elected president, would again refuse to confront Beijing, and that could have disastrous consequences next time.
We're going to get into this in more detail with Joseph Bosco as well. But Gordon, I wanted to draw you out on the possibility that this will become the prelude to future difficulties with China if they perceive not only that they have somebody that they know will not respond forcefully to their aggression, but have every reason to believe he may actually enable it in a fashion by his inactivity. I wanted to ask you about a related point, Gordon. There is some evidence, and I don't know that it's conclusive by any means, but some evidence that Xi may be facing difficulty at home within his own ruling circle. He is, of course, the dictator for life. He is seemingly the most powerful one since Mao's day. And yet, there is some indication that there's restiveness within the party elite. What do we know about it, and what do you make of what might come of it, if anything?
For the last 3 or 4 months, but especially in the last month, there's been open criticism from senior figures in the party about Xi Jinping's performance. And that would be natural, considering that 2019 and this year have been one of setbacks for Beijing because of Xi Jinping's aggressive moves. Of course, we don't know the details of what's occurring in Beijing, but right now we know that there is turmoil. And that's not to say that Xi Jinping won't emerge even more powerful, but it is to say that there is controversy, and we've got to be concerned that now Xi Jinping has a very low threshold of risk, and he may try to solve his problems at home by even more aggression abroad. So now's a moment where the United States has to spend a lot of effort, more effort, in deterring the Chinese.
This is a phenomenon not unfamiliar to those of us who watched the behavior of various totalitarian regimes and systems, that when they get in trouble domestically, they do often engage in what's been called by the political scientists, I think, social engineering, you know, projecting that there's some adversary that has to be contended and everybody needs to rally around the flag and accept a degree of heightened oppression at home, oftentimes, in order to meet this external challenge. Gordon, this brings me to another development that probably is weighing on the Chinese leadership, and that is, again, the evidence is inconclusive as far as I can tell, but what do you understand is going on with the health of Kim Jong-un, the North Korean puppet of Beijing, and the possibility that his sister may be emerging as the new leader of the Kim dynasty as a result of his ill health?
It looks like Kim has gone through another bout of something. We don't know what, but there have been more reports in the last month of Kim Yo-jung, his sister, receiving powers, including some say being the head of the organization and guidance department of the Korean Workers' Party. OGD is the power behind the throne, and if indeed she's heading it, that means she's in a solid position to replace her brother or at least exercise power while he's incapacitated. But we got to remember, Frank, that Kim Yo-jung is not the only Kim family member who has support among regime elements. So does a guy named Kim Pyong-il, who is Kim Jong-un's uncle, and he's now back from Europe, which means that he's at least in a position to challenge Kim Yo-jung. We don't know who's ahead. We don't know about Kim Jong-un's health. But we can see that these reports coming out of North Korea that we hear through South Korea do indicate that there is something going on in the North Korean capital.
As I understand it, a former South Korean foreign minister has actually said he's hearing that Kim Jong-un is actually comatose and that hence this vacuum of power is being filled by his sister already. But we'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, Gordon Chang, and I hope you'll keep us abreast. Let me ask you about one other piece of this larger mix, Gordon, and that is I understand that the Director of National Intelligence in the Trump administration has come to the same conclusion that I think Joe is going to talk with us about of his predecessor, namely that China is the existential threat of our time, or words to that effect. This isn't a surprise to you. You've been warning of this for quite some time. But you'd think that this would cause a heightened degree of concern about what seems to be intensifying Chinese interference in our elections. And we'll get into that a bit with Kevin Freeman in the next block. But what's your reading on how the Chinese threat is being perceived in particularly democratic circles at the moment and the seeming bipartisan consensus of these intelligence leaders that we cannot ignore the magnitude of the danger it poses?
Well, Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe called China the greatest threat to the United States, and he's certainly right about that. In Joe Biden's acceptance speech last Thursday, he only mentioned China once in passing, and that was in connection with supply chains. The Democratic Party platform mentions China in a number of places with actually good statements, but nonetheless, we have a feeling that China is not at the top of the list of the campaign issues for the former vice president. One thing that is concerned is that it is clear that China has thrown its full weight behind the vice president's campaign. We see this not only public diplomacy and their disinformation campaigns, but also their use of social media and in ways which are illicit in order to support the Biden campaign. And I would hope that the vice president would actually come out and tell the Chinese to stop supporting him, because this is much more, we're seeing much more Chinese involvement this year in support of the Democratic nominee than Russia in 2016, whatever it was trying to do then. China is much more in force this time.
Yeah, indeed. I think it makes what went on in the actual case of Russia, and not to say what was said about collusion and its interference in the election by some partisan critics of President Trump, but the actual evidence of what the Russians were up to pales into its significance by what the Chinese are doing here. Even if you set aside, and we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly with Kevin, the indications that it is actually involved with some of the organizations that are engaged in rioting in our country, one of the elements of the unrestricted warfare playbook.
Radio Free Asia is reporting that a unit of China's People's Liberation Army was actually working out of the Houston consulate to help the Black Lives Matter and the Antifa organizations subvert the United States. This is unconfirmed, but nonetheless, it is a matter of further investigation for the American people.
Yeah, and may have something to do with the Trump administration's closure of that facility. Their influence operations, their media and propaganda arms, their economic activities and the like, Gordon Chang, are all, it seems to be ramping up for greater and greater, well, efforts to subvert the re-election campaign of President Trump and secure the election of a man that they have every reason to believe is going to be much more to their liking, namely Vice President Joe Biden. This is a subject to which we will return with you, Gordon, among others, and we so appreciate your insights and expertise and the good work that you are doing on all of these fronts. I look forward to our next visit with you next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and keep up that great work. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman and talk about unrestricted warfare and the effort to distill its various component parts with him and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a particular welcome to one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin is, of course, a best-selling author of Secret Weapon and Game Plan and a blogger par excellence at globaleconomicwarfare.com. But you can find most of what he does most readily at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back. I am particularly excited about some things that you've been doing recently, Kevin, through and with Economic War Room. And one of them is a topic that we've touched on a couple of times now. And I gather you did at some length with our mutual friend Andrew Whitney about this product called Oleandrin that may have promise as a, well, a cure for the CCP virus. Talk a little bit about your program with Andrew recently and so your takeaway from it.
Well, Frank, first off, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a researcher. I don't understand necessarily all whether this is a cure or not. But what I do know is I can see when someone's trying to hide something, cover up, marginalize, make it go away. When I see that, I know it. I've seen it with my research at the Pentagon regarding the risks of economic warfare. They did it 10 years ago. There's no way China would ever hurt us, they told us, over and over and over. And I heard this at the highest levels inside the Pentagon and in the intelligence agencies and so forth. And me think they just protest too much. And in this case, with Andrew Whitney and Phoenix Biotechnologies and Oleandrin, the vitriolic attack on Mike Lindell by Anderson Cooper and everything else to try and keep the American public from looking at Oleandrin tells me there's a couple of things going on. One of them is a lot of people are going to make a lot of money if we don't have a cure, or it's a reason to attack the president, because the president said he would look at this promising treatment that brought to him by Ben Carson, among others. He said, oh, we'll look at it. We should test that, basically. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. And the fact that they've protested it so much is a reason the American public should find out everything they can about this. So we did a show on it. We've made the full show available on YouTube. We've also made it available on our XOTV channel. You can find it if you go to economicwarroom.com and see a half-hour interview with Andrew Whitney where he talks about, he walks through all of the objections that were laid out so boldly that turn out to be all three of them turn out to be completely false. So it is desperately needed for people to see this and watch this to understand what the deep state interests are trying to keep you from seeing. You know, if they don't want you to see it, I want to see it.
The three lines of attack seem to be that it's unsafe because it is a molecule derived from a toxic plant, oleander. Second, that it is unproven in terms of its effectiveness against this terrible disease, COVID-19, as it's generally called. And that the effort to get it some attention has involved, you know, in running the FDA process. And I gather you've established in the course of your program that those three contentions are unfounded.
Oh, absolutely. Number one, Botox is poison. It's botulinum toxin, and yet people use it all the time for medicinal and cosmetic purposes. And there are a lot of natural things that we consume all the time that at the wrong dose could be fatal. So that's a falsehood just because it's derived from oleander. I mean, penicillin is derived from mold. So that's not an excuse to not look at it.
And it's also passed safety tests with the FDA, as I understand it, phase one and phase two clinical trials.
It has gone through the trial process, right. And there are multiple studies where they look at this for efficacy. And you can't just toss it. Well, it's not been proven to be efficacious. Well, neither has any of the vaccines that they're looking at. Not one of them has been proven to be successful. So does that mean you stop looking at them?
But there is some anecdotal evidence that suggests that it does work highly effectively, as well as lab evidence at UTMB, the University of Texas Medical Branch down your way. So, Kevin, and then the third thing, I guess, is that, you know, this has been going through an FDA application process for, well, 2 months formally, and I think for months before that informally. And the question really is, what's being asked of the FDA at this point is just the permission to do extensive medical testing of it in hospitals and so on, look at it properly, and put the product on the so-called dietary list so that it can be purchased as a natural supplement, which is certainly something that would give people an option for taking advantage of it, even if it's not proven as a cure, assuming it is
safe.
Yeah,
that's the key issue is if it's safe, and it's been proven to be safe, and if it's proven to be safe, of course they should let it be used.
Well, thank you again for drilling down on this because it is something, it seems to me, we need to look at carefully and get the tests done, get the FDA on the case constructively. This is something the president tweeted about last week, and the result of that seems to have been that the FDA bestirred itself to get this so-called convalescence plasma treatment into the mix, and this would seem to me to be an equally important candidate, if not more so. Hey, Kevin, let me switch gears on you, because one of the other things that you've been doing with your team at Economic War Room, and again, folks, I just want to commend the program that they produce and the products that come of it, including the battle plans that Kevin and his team produce with each of their shows. Really an extraordinary public service, and you need to take those aboard because they're about what you can do if you're moved by the content of the shows. But Kevin, one of the other products that you've just been knocking out, and we believe will be available shortly, both at your site, economicwarroom.com, and at the Committee on the Present Danger China's site, is the, and that is presentdangerchina.org, is what you call two-minute warnings. Tell us about those and what the content is that makes them so important at this moment in time particularly.
Well, Frank, it's been about a dozen years since I brought the book Unrestricted Warfare to the attention of a lot of policymakers, including a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And most people never heard of it, but it is the manual that China seems to have been following for the past dozen years, and really actually for 20 years, in taking America down and replacing America leadership with Chinese leadership.
This book is, of course, Unrestricted Warfare. It's a playbook that seems to have been operationalized for some 21 years. So get into some of the things that you found as you went through each of its techniques for waging that kind of warfare against us.
Well, let me just list a few, and then I'll walk through one, for example. Financial warfare, smuggling warfare, cultural warfare, drug warfare, media warfare, technological warfare, resources warfare, psychological warfare, network warfare, international law warfare, economic aid warfare, combination method, space warfare, biological warfare. And I just as examples, I took one overview and 17 examples, and I'll just pull up cultural warfare as that example. The Chinese Communist Party now controls what movies we see. And people say, that's absurd. No, it's not absurd, because they have so infiltrated Hollywood that they're not allowed in Hollywood to make a movie that the Chinese censors wouldn't approve of. And even movies that you think are really basic, you think, well, a Winnie the Pooh movie, they made a movie about Christopher Robin. Well, it didn't have the box office it should have because it was banned in China because somebody said that President Xi looks like Winnie the Pooh, and so Winnie the Pooh's banned in China. And it's Top Gun's, the flight jacket that Tom Cruise would wear doesn't have a patch from Japan or Taiwan like it should because, well, the Chinese censors forbade it. And they're controlling the movie content. And if you control entertainment, you control culture. If you control culture, you control politics. And so this is a method of warfare written about in the book that we're seeing carried out on the movies, in the movies that we're watching today.
Kevin, one of the other things that you've discovered in your research and your reporting on not just what the Chinese have aspired to do, but what they've actually been doing is, of course, the identification in unrestricted warfare of social unrest and rioting as another instrument that could be utilized by the Chinese Communist Party. Very quickly, tell us about that and what you found in your two-minute warning that you want the public to be aware of, and not just about sort of this as an abstract proposition, but as something that's been actually operationalized.
Well, one of the methods that I described is the combination method. And basically, we have Communist China writing that the goal is to cause America to fall into social panic, street riots, and a political crisis. That's the end game. And I brought this to the attention of leaders in the Pentagon a dozen years ago, and they laughed. And they said, we're far too stable of a society to have that kind of rioting again. It's not a problem. It's not a risk. And they laughed at me. And yet here we face, whether it's on the streets of Portland or the streets of Kenosha, which is a sleepy little town in Wisconsin. I mean, it's a great town. I've been there, and yet there's mass rioting. And these are planned and perpetrated, and you can see the Chinese fingerprints all over these, including the fact that you can watch embassy personnel going out and participating or at least attending some of these riots. You can see money trails that tie back directly to Chinese communist influence. Our friend Trevor Loudon has done that work. And you see the gleeful writing in the Chinese papers about how wonderful it is that they're having racial problems in America. And they call us a racist nation and everything, where they're perhaps the most racist nation on earth. The way they've treated Africans during the pandemic was terrible. The way they treat other non-Chinese in their dealings around the world is horrifying.
It is. And racist sort of lines of attack for dividing and undermining Western societies, notably ours, is definitely part of the Marxist playbook, not just the Chinese one. Kevin Freeman, so much more to talk about. We look forward to the rollout of these 18 two-minute warnings, and we'll be talking more about them in the days ahead, I'm sure. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again next week, if you will. Next up, we're going to speak with Joseph Bosco about what China is up to in the military arena and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by a man I admire greatly for his service to our country, both in the Pentagon, where he served as the country desk officer for the Secretary of Defense, on the China portfolio for a time. He is continuing his important service to our country, now as a fellow with two institutes, the Institute for Taiwan-American Studies and also the Institute for Korean-American Studies as well. His name is Joseph Bosco. He is an attorney by training, but a public policy expert, as well as a national security practitioner and an essayist, often at The Hill newspaper, on topics that we very much appreciate being able to visit with him about, including today. Joe, it's good to have you back. Welcome. You have a piece that's just coming out today at The Hill, I understand, about Joe Biden's policy approach over the years towards, well, China, Taiwan, and the Western Pacific. We'll talk a little bit about your views on what Donald Trump has been about in those regards, but start with Joe Biden, if you would.
Well, it's hard to know where to start because he's been, I won't say all over the place, but he's had several inconsistent statements and comments on both the relationship with China and Taiwan issues. So it's a moving target, and I thought his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention last week was indicative. He had one single reference to China with all the issues that we have with that country, that governmental system, I should say. He only had one reference, and that was that we should not be dependent upon them for our medical equipment. But, of course, there's a range of extremely critical issues confronting the U.S. from China. In fact, during the Obama-Biden administration, the director of national intelligence called China the greatest mortal threat to the United States. Now, that's a pretty serious indictment, and in fact, the record confirms that. But yet all Biden had to say about it was we shouldn't get our medical equipment from them.
You know, it really is. It is stunning, Joe, because I'm of the view, and I think you are too, that whether you look at the national security portfolio or our economic portfolio, or now obviously our public health portfolio, it's pretty clear that job one for the next commander in chief is going to be the People's Republic of China under the Chinese Communist Party. So the idea that this would not feature more prominently in his, you know, major address to the, not just the Democratic Convention, of course, but the American people, is kind of astonishing to me, I have to say. And it bespeaks some of the policies that he's actually pursued towards China over the years, doesn't it? One of the things that is, of course, prominent in that regard was he was an instrumental figure in engineering a memorandum of understanding between the United States and China that essentially allowed them access to our capital markets without having to conform to our securities laws or regulations. Again, as a student of these things, I know you know how consequential that access, that opportunity to underwrite their behavior, their malevolent behavior at that, has been, Joe. But do you think he's not interested in talking about this because he considers it a major liability?
I think it's a combination of things. I think part of it is to do with the influence of the people around him. After all, he comes from an administration that has a history of policy toward China and Taiwan, and many of those advisors are now involved in his campaign, and presumably if he were to be elected, they would be part of the administration. So he has that influence on him. The center of gravity of the Democratic Party, first of all on national security, has been left of center. They are very averse to the use of force or even talking about the use of force, being in any way firm against our adversaries. And so there's that problem that the party itself leans in that direction. Biden himself, I think, has, as I said, he's vacillated all over the place. There's that delicious quote recently where someone asked him about China and then the danger, and his quote was something to the effect that, come on, man, they're not bad folks. They're not out to eat our lunch. I mean, this was a very unserious comment. By the way, on the point of our capital markets, I do want to put in a plug for the work that your committee has done. It's been incredible. I frankly was totally unaware of this aspect of China's infiltration into our system and its malevolent influence, but your committee has exposed. Roger Robinson has done sterling work on this. has exposed the way they've come into the markets without meeting any of the standards that every other United States company has to meet when it registers for the stock market in terms of accountability, transparency, auditing, and all the rest. And we've let them off the hook simply because they've said, this is a matter of our national security. We don't give that information out.
Right, because they've been enriching some people on Wall Street, it seems, primarily, I guess, is the consideration. Well, Joe, thank you very much for that. The Committee on the Present Danger of China has really been, I think, enormously effective in making this case with Roger Robinson's help and help of others like yourself who are, you know, amplifiers of this work. It's really appreciated. And I was very heartened in my commentary today. I talk a little bit about Undersecretary of State Keith Kroc's recent warning to the universities that they ought to divest from Chinese companies because there's a very high likelihood that they will be delisted and there will be a loss of value as a result. So this is an important message, we hope, not just to that particular community and its endowments, but also to Wall Street and to, let's be clear, you know, private investors as well. This is time to sell your stocks in China if you can. Joe, let me turn to President Trump because, of course, this is the week that we're hearing from the Republicans. Your thoughts very quickly on the president's policies towards China and how they are likely to, you know, form the crucible perhaps for an important public policy focus in this campaign on what to do about China.
Well, as we all know, the president has focused on the trade issue with China since before he became president. That was his driving force. But hidden in that impetus is the fact that if China really were to make the kinds of structural economic changes that Trump has called for, though that in itself would necessitate political change within China. And that, of course, is why they have resisted it so vehemently, that they do not want to make the kind of economic changes that he's called for. Now, I think we've become quite open about this, and Secretary Pompeo has given a series of speeches, as have other cabinet officers, indicating that the Chinese communist system is the problem. It's the inherent threat to just about every Western ideal and institution, and to its own people, of course. And so I think this is the first time in my lifetime, and I've been waiting a long time for this, to hear someone in a responsible position in the U.S. government say it's Chinese communism that we have got to get rid of, that the Chinese people have got to get rid of, and we ought to be supporting them just as we did the people of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to get rid of that communist system. So I'm very much encouraged by what the president's doing in this area.
And Joe, just as an astute observer of these things over decades of public service and monitoring the workings of the United States government, do you anticipate that the differences between President Trump and Vice President Biden will be an important feature of this upcoming election?
I certainly would hope that the Trump campaign will make it an issue, and I believe that others in our society will draw attention to it as well. I'm certainly calling attention to, I'm making comparisons on a weekly basis in my columns as to who's doing what or saying what about this most important threat that the country faces, and people will form their own judgments on it. But the record is pretty clear, and I think we're at a very historic inflection point, and I think the Trump administration's on the right side of it, and I hope that Pompeo and the others, Pence, will continue giving these great speeches which highlight the really moral issues at the core of our confrontation.
Well, speeches is one thing. I think the actions that they're taking are also important, and both, as you said, Joe Bosco, are important focuses for a debate between the parties and the American people as they go to the polls. We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you very much again for this conversation and also these terrific columns that you write week upon week at the Hill newspaper. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll keep coming back to us as well. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.